Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the latest speculation following the involvement of Roger Ailes and the hiring of Breitbart's Stephen Bannon as the new CEO of the Trump campaign, that Trump is looking past a loss in November to monetize his success as a candidate by turning his voters into viewers of Trump TV. Julian Zelizer, a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University, joins us to discuss his article at the Los Angeles Times, "Maybe Trump's Not Trying to Win the White House, He's Trying to Start Trump TV," and reports that Trump plans to build a media empire with himself as the star attraction, having become addicted to the adoration of the crowds at his rallies. We'll look into how Trump and his new sidekick Bannon, who thinks Fox News is tame, could continue to feed red meat to the far right, along with millennium apocalyptic scenarios and conspiracy theories about the oppression of white America. Then we'll assess whether Aetna Insurance is blackmailing the Obama administration with their threat to pull out of Obamacare if the Department of Justice does not approve Aetna's merger with the other insurance giant Humana, thus leaving only three big players controlling the health insurance market. Wendell Potter, who, after a long career in the for-profit health industry as a chief corporate spokesman at Cigna Corporation and as head of corporate communications at Humana, who is now a senior analyst on healthcare at the Center for Public Integrity and is the author of Obamacare, What's in It for Me, What Everyone Needs to Know About the Affordable Care, joins us to discuss how much the federal government already subsidizes the insurance giants and why, at the end of the day, single payer makes the most sense. Then finally, we will speak with Robert Perkinson, who is an American historian and professor of American studies at the University of Hawaii, the co-founder of a criminal justice reform coalition in Connecticut, and currently a board member of the Drug Policy Forum in Hawaii. He is the author of Texas Tough, The Rise of a Prison Empire. And we will discuss the Department of Justice decision today that the U.S. will end federal use of private prisons, a move that may have a trickle-down effect on the states where 90% of America's prisoners are held. And joining us now, Julian Zelizer, who is a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University and a New America Fellow. His books include Governing America, The Revival of Political History, and his latest book is The Fierce Urgency of Now, Lyndon Johnson, Congress, and the Battle for the Great Society. And he has an op-ed with Levy Tillerman at the Los Angeles Times, "Maybe Trump's Not Trying to Win the White House, He's Trying to Start Trump TV." Welcome to Background Briefing, Julian Zelizer.
Thanks for having me.
And the idea that Trump, first of all, I think you have to go back to the correspondence dinner where President Obama said that Donald Trump entered the political race to basically improve his brand, Trump, and it sort of got, it took him by surprise, shall we say. So that's a sort of, I think, a beginning premise. Do you think, though, is he not serious about this race? Does that still apply that he's basically not serious about this? This is all about self-improvement. And because of the adoration of these crowds that clearly are a drug to him, he's now sort of segueing into the idea of not just having 15 minutes worth of fame, but having his own television network.
Well, there's two ways to look at it. One is a more cynical way that President Obama outlined that, you know, Trump only had limited interest in politics. He got into this to promote himself, to promote all the different items that he sells, from real estate to different kinds of products, and that this got bigger than he imagined. And here he is, and now he's the nominee. And if he doesn't lose, what he would obviously want to do is continue where he started, to capitalize on all the fame and attention and fans and support that this brought him. A different way to look at it is less cynical, regardless of the origins of why he got into this. As a Republican nominee, he's enjoyed being part of the political debate. He's enjoyed having all these very passionate supporters, but it's not looking like he's going to win at this point. And his campaign by all measures, is going very poorly. And so he's thinking about what the next thing to do is. And what we talk about is we've seen many Republicans and Democrats who have thought about the next step in politics when you lose is going into the media. And for someone who came from the media, who had a very big show on television, this could be a natural step for him and something that is very attractive to create a power base in the media to continue to be present and influential on these kinds of issues.
And the evidence so far, I guess going back to June, there was an article in Vanity Fair that suggested that Trump wanted to monetize his success as a candidate by turning his voters into viewers. And also, Trump recently said that he might end up taking a nice long vacation after November. So I guess the other big clues are, at least people are sort of interpreting them as clues, and that is Roger Ailes helping it with the debate prep and this appointment of Steve Bannon from Breitbart News. How do those last two figures fit into the scenario?
Well, both of them first come from the world of the media. This is what they do. They specialize in this particular world of the conservative slash political media that has been so important in recent years. And so bringing them on doesn't necessarily make sense for a candidate who's struggling to recover in the presidential election. Neither of them have particular skills in all the things that have been lacking for Donald Trump, containing the candidate, selling the candidate to moderate voters, organizing at the grassroots level to make sure there's voter turnout. They don't bring any of this to the table. And both Breitbart News and Fox News promote a style of rhetoric that does exactly the opposite of what Trump needs to do in the coming months if he's going to recover, that is, move away from the kind of extremism that he has displayed. So it's not clear that they do anything on that front. But bringing two big media figures to help him would only amplify a campaign that in the next few months centers on solidifying and in some ways intensifying the Trump persona that has emerged in this campaign, which would be something that could translate into a big media operation. So I think that's very important. And obviously Fox News is also in a bit of a tumultuous period right now. So there's actually an opening for something like this to happen.
And again, I'm speaking with Julian Zelizer, who's a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University and a New America Fellow. His books include Governing America, The Revival of Political History, and his latest book is The Fierce Urgency of Now, Lyndon Johnson, Congress, and the Battle for the Great Society. And he has an op-ed with Levy Tillerman at the Los Angeles Times. Maybe Trump's not trying to win the White House. He's trying to start Trump TV. Now, I don't know whether you caught the speech that Trump made the other night from Milwaukee, although ostensibly it wasn't. He spoke about African-Americans and the riots, et cetera, and how he had concerns for their security in their neighborhoods, but he spoke at a safe distance about 45 minutes away in a totally white suburb. But what was interesting about the speech was that it's extremely well-written, well-crafted, and very, very effective. If he had given it months ago, I think he'd probably be ahead in the polls. He borrowed from Bernie Sanders and a whole other panoply of people and tried to paint himself as a populist outsider, and that Hillary Clinton and the whole establishment, including the media establishment, doesn't want you, the American people. They want to keep you in your place, and they want to keep the system going as it is, and he wants to free you from the clutches of this rigged system. Now, I thought when I watched this whole speech, I thought, my God, maybe Ailes' fingerprints are on this. There's some adult supervision going on there. Do you have any insight into what happened, why he suddenly delivered a very, very smart speech?
I don't know. I don't have any insight into the campaign, or I don't have any insight into who in particular advised him on that, or more importantly than advising him is convincing him to actually deliver a speech as scripted, which is something he hasn't wanted to do. You know, part of it is clearly there is a sense of desperation at this point among Republicans and even within his own campaign. I think Trump, for all his bombast, is aware of the challenge he is facing at this point and is very worried about suffering from a humiliating outcome. And there's part of him, even if he's going to lose, would like to lose with respectable margins so that this doesn't make him look like someone who's politically incompetent. It could be some of the new people surrounding him did push this kind of a speech, though it's not a reason that would explain why he actually gave it. And there's still been plenty of the other Trump. I think the problem with Trump is not that there's not an occasional moment when he can deliver a somewhat cogent message or do so in a way that fits political norms, but it's what happens for the other 23 hours when he goes off script. And so, you know, I'm not sure he's actually been contained at this point.
Well, if Roger Ailes didn't have his fingerprints on it somebody else did, it did sort of smack of adult supervision. And Ailes certainly has a long track record of helping Nixon and helping Reagan.
Yep.
And frankly, there's nobody probably much left on the planet that Trump would actually listen to. I think he actually might even listen to Ailes. But Ailes, of course, has been eased out of Fox largely by the two boys, the Murdoch boys, James and Lachlan, who want to change Fox and make it more millennial friendly. They recognize the demographics are angry old white people who are going to die off, and therefore they're going to look to the future. I think that's a heavy lift because I think the brand is so tainted. But what's amazing about the brand, Fox News, is that Bannon and Breitbart, who have just been hired by Trump, they think Fox News is tame, right?
Right. No, right. I, first of all, the idea that Fox will fundamentally rebrand itself is questionable. There are not many brands that are as known and have created as much of an impression in the media world as Fox has. And it's going to be very hard to shed that and to really start winning over millennial voters who, to begin with, don't actually watch television as much and look to other outlets if they want to learn about the news than these kinds of networks. I think it's going to be very hard for them to do that, but I think that is also true. Ailes and Breitbart are eager to go even further with the kind of news that has been central to Fox, and they believe that it's commercially the most viable thing to do. It's also the way to appeal to all these core voters, to get louder, to get angrier, and to get more aggressive, and to cut even deeper. And this is why a partnership with Trump in many ways could be very appealing if this election continues to move in this direction.
So in effect, is Trump, let's say he's got 30%. There's 30% of people in this country who are hardcore supporters of Trump, Tea Party types, whatever, you know, whatever that you want to describe the demographic that he has. Most people think he can't get above 30, but he's more or less captured. So let's assume he's captured 30% of the country. That's not a bad kind of constituency, right, to have for a TV network. It sounds like he's not that interested in, you know, if he's not interested in winning the election by broadening his message out to the center, then he's probably not interested in a broader media footprint, but he's just interested in the people he's already captured and milking them.
Yeah, I mean, I think there are some estimates that it might be higher, his final count. It might be closer to 40%, which is where the Republican electorate might fall, regardless of who the candidate was. Part of it is a polarized electorate, so he might pull, say, the 30 to 40%, and that's not all about Trump. It's just that Republicans will vote Republican in this day and age, and they're not going to defect to the Democratic Party, and they're not going to not vote just to prove a point about who their nominee is. So some of that we have to take with a grain of salt. But it's true. It says a lot about where the party is, where the voters are, that he can get anywhere in this range, given many of the statements that he has made. There is an appetite for this. There is a support, even with all the Republican defectors, to hear this kind of rhetoric, to hear this kind of message, and to listen to someone with this persona. And it's not shifting from, say this doesn't work and he moves to a different platform, moving from elected office to the conservative media, especially with the kinds of interests that exist, it's a continuation of politics in this day and age. It's not as if the media is a separate world. We've seen that. So this could still be a very powerful platform for him to have influence. And you could imagine a station created that takes what Fox News has done and goes much further and plays to some of the issues that he has brought up in his campaign, including issues like immigration and national security.
Well, apparently in the severance package that Roger Ailes got from his friend Rupert Murdoch was about $40 million in cash, and I believe there was a clause that he couldn't work for any of the other networks for 4 years. I don't know whether there was a clause saying you can't start your own network. But let's assume that Trump, Ailes, and Bannon want to start Trump TV and capitalize on Trump's fleeting popularity at the moment. I'm not sure that, frankly, after the election, people aren't going to tire of him. But his own supporters, judging by those that show up at his rallies, are deeply enthusiastic. So let's assume that he captures this 30%. He'll be competing with Fox, won't he?
He would be competing with Fox. That is true. But no one would go into a new network with the same kind of built-in audience as he would. And he does, there is one arena that he is very good at, and it is this arena. And for all the awkwardness that's emerged on the political campaign trail, when those television cameras are on, and now when the social media is open on his computer, he knows how to work that room. And I think Fox is at an unusual moment right now with Ailes leaving, and there is the potential for a competitor to emerge. So I just think from the perspective of the media, there is space for a new network with that Trump flavor to succeed.
But there aren't any network assets to buy in terms of terrestrial TV and owned and operated. They're all controlled by the existing networks. Fox was able to buy up some other networks that were people that want to get out of the business, etc. But there's nothing on the market, is it? So how would you have a new TV network? It sounds like it'll start on the internet.
Well, it could ease. I think television is obviously changing. So the internet is already creating a platform for many new operations. Some have been successful, some not. But it could easily be some kind of internet innovation where that's where the station begins. I don't know how this would look, and nor do we suggest we have some roadmap into what he's thinking of. But somewhere in this world of the media, there's plenty of opportunities for him to start something big, should he not be the president of the United States. And the world of the internet has now created many possibilities for starting new operations that didn't exist in the era of the networks in the 1950s and 60s.
But the jobs that he did have, The Apprentice was with NBC and the Miss Universe or Miss World,
yep,
or whatever he had, he lost both of them, didn't he? So he doesn't have, he can't recreate The Apprentice, or he can't recreate Miss World, can he?
No, I don't think that's what he would do. Although, who knows, maybe he'd have some kind of political, you know, reality show at this point. It's so hard to know or to predict where this all goes, given what we've seen. You never want to take anything off the table. But I imagine, even if he got, as we started by saying, even if he got into this for reasons other than actually winning, I do think there is a part of him that has enjoyed this political success, that has enjoyed the taste of power and the potential to be a political leader, which he is. Even without winning, he has become this political leader. So my guess is his ambitions in terms of something in the media, should he not win, would be much grander than starting The Apprentice again. It would be something that would allow him to shape the debate, to take on the Democratic president, and to really remain a power broker in politics through the medium where he's most comfortable.
Well, just in closing, Julian Salazar, there, a number of people have speculated that the Trump entry into this race and the subsequent meltdown that many are predicting will end up splitting the Republican Party. And there's some doubt as to whether the traditional kind of Chamber of Commerce wing would win out over the Tea Party wing, who would end up, in effect, with the rump GOP. Is it possible that this would be an adjunct to a new political party, Trump TV?
Maybe. I think the Republicans have had this split for a while now. It's not as if in 2016 all of a sudden the party was facing these two factions and that there was a civil war that was no longer sustainable. The Tea Party's been around now since 2009/10. That Tea Party grew out of the Newt Gingrich wing of the Republican Party, which emerged in the 1980s. So the GOP has had this division for a while. And I think the wing of the party that has relied on the conservative media will continue to. I think the party can actually sustain these divisions. And my guess is if Donald Trump really suffers a major loss, it will only empower the other wing of the Republican Party for the time being, not to the point they foreclose the other from being part of the party, but where one becomes a dominant voice. I still don't see a third party emerging, and I think this two-party system is going to last, and I think the Republicans will just live with this uneasy alliance that's formed.
Well, Julian Salazar, I thank you very much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Julian Salazar, who's a professor of history and public affairs at Princeton University and a New America Fellow. His books include Governing America, The Revival of Political History, and his latest book is The Fierce Urgency of Now, Lyndon Johnson, Congress, and the Battle for the Great Society. And he has an op-ed with Levy Tillerman at the Los Angeles Times. Maybe Trump's not trying to win the White House. He's trying to start Trump TV. We're going to take a brief station break and back assessing whether Aetna Insurance is blackmailing the Obama administration with their threat to pull out of Obamacare if the DOJ does not approve Aetna's merger with Humana. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Wendell Potter, who, after a long career in the for-profit health industry as the chief corporate spokesman at Cigna Corporation and as head of corporate communications at Humana, Inc., is now a senior analyst on healthcare at the Center for Public Integrity. His books include Obamacare, What's in It for Me, What Everyone Needs to Know About the Affordable Care Act, and his latest is Nation on the Take, How Big Money Corrupts Our Democracy and What We Can Do About It. Welcome to Background Briefing, Wendell Potter.
Ian, thank you very much.
And your former company that you were the corporate communications head at Humana, Inc., of course, have said that they're going to withdraw from Obamacare along with United Health Group. And Aetna Incorporated back in July warned the DOJ that they would exit the Obamacare health insurance market if the government challenged this deal to buy Humana. So is this some form of blackmail here that's going on? Or is Obamacare unraveling?
I think it's blackmail. I really do. I think it's extortion. These companies have pretty much gotten their way with the government for so long, they think they can just get whatever they want through intimidation. And I think this is exactly what's going on. Now, that said, these big companies have not figured out yet how to make a lot of money off of the Obamacare plans. This is a fairly new market for them, as well as it is for the nonprofit plans, which are staying with Obamacare. But these big for-profits have to take a quite a bit of money off of the top of the premiums to reward shareholders and to pay their overly paid executives. They're finding that they're just not they just haven't figured out how to make a lot of money on that market yet. Keep in mind, Ian, that this is a market that they did not want to serve. They thought with the subsidies from the government and other money from the government that they can probably make out like bandits, but it hasn't turned out that way, primarily because many of the people in this market and who are buying the Obamacare policies, many of them couldn't buy coverage at all in the past because they'd been sick in the past. It was a very common practice in the health insurance industry before Obamacare for these companies to blackball people, to declare them uninsurable if they had been sick in the past. So you can imagine there was great pent-up demand by people who were not well, who couldn't go to the doctor, who couldn't get the care they needed because they couldn't get insurance. So we shouldn't shed any crocodile tears for these guys. They're greedy and they're trying to intimidate the government, in my view, to try to change the rules to make it easier for them to make a few bucks.
But are they powerful enough if United Healthcare Group, Humana, and Aetna leave the Obamacare health insurance market? Will that begin the unraveling? At this point, the Anthem, Cigna say they're losing money, but they're going to stick it out.
Yeah, and Anthem in particular has a presence in more markets than the other companies. Most of the Anthem plans are Blue Cross plans, which have more experience in working with or selling policies on the individual market, which is what Obamacare is. The plans are sold to individuals and to families, not through employers, of course. So even if these companies leave, it will not be a huge loss. These companies operate in their national companies, but they don't operate in all the states to start with, number one. And number two, they don't have a whole lot of members. Most of the people who've signed up for coverage throughout the country have signed up for coverage through other plans, like Kaiser Permanente in California, for example, a lot of other nonprofit plans across the country. That's important to keep in mind. There are a lot of companies that are still offering coverage through the Obamacare exchanges. More and more of them are beginning to turn a profit or at least break even. A big difference is that the nonprofit plans don't have to report earnings to shareholders every 3 months. With these big for-profit companies, it's a short-term profit look, if you will. In other words, they have to tell their shareholders every 3 months how well they're doing financially. They're doing very well. All these companies, United and WellPoint, United and Aetna and Humana, are pleasing shareholders on all their other books of business, but this is a one which is really quite small that they're not making a lot of money on. And so the shareholders are saying, we don't want you to continue in something, or at least their executives are saying that. We would prefer not to continue losing any money. That's the way it is.
So whether or not this is coming from Wall Street or from the CEOs and perhaps even the shareholders, this is really, it does seem to be a case of, did Obama miscalculate? I mean, I thought the whole idea of Obamacare was, and you mentioned it earlier, was to get them into the tent by offering them a whole bunch of new customers, and it's not proving to be quite as lucrative as they hoped. And it, obviously, these moves on their part, this effort to sort of, in effect, blackmail the administration through the DOJ by saying that they're going to pull out unless the DOJ approves the merger between Humana and Aetna, So just losing a little bit on one division, that's enough.
Yeah.
In other words, greed is good and Obamacare is bad for them.
That's the way it is when you're dealing with these for-profit insurance companies. And once again, people need to understand that there are other options. In most states, you can sign up for a plan through a nonprofit health insurance plan, and I certainly would if I were buying a policy through Obamacare. I would look to try to enroll in a nonprofit health plan. Keep in mind too that Aetna and Humana and United all are making a ton of money off of taxpayers, off of the federal government and state governments. Few people know this, but in recent years, these companies are getting more of their revenue from the government than from the private sector. These companies are selling a lot of coverage through their so-called Medicare Advantage plans, and they also are very big in the Medicaid programs. They manage a lot of the state's Medicaid programs around the country, and of course, that program is financed by the combination of federal and state dollars. So taxpayers are really contributing a lot of the revenues of these companies. And also, for Aetna in particular, Aetna's, when it announced second quarter earnings, its shareholders were really quite pleased with its overall performance. Its earnings increased 8.5% for this second quarter of 2016 over the same period last year. And its revenues for just this three-month period of time was almost $16 billion. So these companies are doing very, very well. They don't want you to know that. They want people to think that they're losing money overall, but they're not. They're extraordinarily profitable. They just don't have any sense of civic duty like the nonprofits do.
And the next sign-up period for Obamacare, and this would be the fourth annual open enrollment period under the Obamacare law, it begins on November the 1st, which is a week before Election Day. How's it doing, in terms of an overall picture? I mean, you hear, obviously, Trump is determined to destroy it if he were ever to be elected. And there is a constant, I don't know how many times they try to shut it down in the House.
Yeah, over 50 times, yeah.
Exactly. So the beat goes on in that regard. You do hear anecdotally that this is a case of robbing Peter to pay Paul in order to give a health insurance to people who previously haven't been insured and those with pre-existing conditions who have been sick before that you mentioned earlier. What a lot of people argue is that middle-class people and wealthier people are the ones that are taking it on the chin because the insurance companies are raising their premiums. Is that true?
It is true because the people who are low and moderate income are able to get a subsidy or tax credits from the government to help them pay the premium. So they're not really all that adversely affected by rate increases. People who are not eligible for subsidies because their income is higher are the ones who are suffering the most. Now, that said, most of the people who have enrolled in Obamacare plans are people with incomes that are low enough to make them eligible for subsidies. But it's not perfect by any means. There's a lot of work that we can do and should do. The next administration, if Hillary Clinton is president, and she has a Democratic Senate, and who knows, maybe even a Democratic House, there should be a lot of changes that could be made to improve this. And I think this is something that people should keep in mind when they hear about the private insurance business. We have been led to believe that these companies are essential, that they help control cost. They don't. It's the biggest scam, I think, in this country's history, and that being the private health insurance industry. And I know I work for these companies for 20 years. We grew up with this system. We don't know any different, but it's unique around the world. And these companies, none of them, even these big ones, are not nearly as big, obviously, as the Medicare program. They don't have enough size to be able to really negotiate very good deals at all with the pharmaceutical companies or big health hospital systems. They don't control costs. They've been trying to tell us and employers that for decades, but it's a myth. What they do is just tack on a little bit more money, or they price their premiums above what they expect medical inflation to be in the future. And they frankly do not, they benefit from medical inflation, because when medical prices go up, their revenues increase. So it's a real scam. People don't realize it for the most part, though.
Well, another way to look at it is that they're kind of like the mafia or a protection racket, because they don't bring anything to the table. You know, they are an unnecessary layer between the patient and the caregiver. And that's why the logic of single payer is so much greater. Because what you do pay for in private insurance is essentially you pay their overhead. That's a premium on top of what it would normally cost if all of the money were pooled, as it is with Medicare. And this is the extraordinary myth. And when you start to tell us, as you did a minute ago, Wendell Potter, that these private insurance companies are also making probably more money now off the government itself through Medicare Advantage, which was pushed through during the Bush administration, and when they explicitly forbid the government from negotiating pharmaceutical prices as well, which is why pharmaceutical costs are out of control. This is what they've done. This is a form of right-wing or Republican welfare that we're talking about here. And is there any way, I mean, the more you tell us about, for example, how much money these insurance companies are making out of the government, it makes you think, my God, you know, why didn't they go to single payer? I know the political reasons why they didn't, but my God, the logic of single payer is screaming out at everybody, saying, hey, wait a minute, you know, the government's already getting hosed, so let's just cut this nonsense and these unnecessary subsidies to these people who are ripping you off and provide nothing except a justification for their bureaucratic mishandling of your health needs. It's crazy.
It is crazy, Ian. I fault our media too. The media doesn't really cover this industry thoroughly enough. So the media, in many ways, is complicit in keeping these companies in business. Employers, Ian, are beginning to catch on. They are realizing that these middlemen are not adding any value. They're adding cost to their operations. And so employers are increasingly looking to contract directly with hospital systems and healthcare systems around the country, rather than deal with the insurance companies. They're able to carve out that layer of expense. And I think the insurance company executives are probably seeing the handwriting on the wall. They're trying to make as much money as they can right now. But the game is going to be up before too long, because employers who are their biggest employee, their biggest customers, are beginning to realize they're just not essential.
Well, if it can't be done politically, and obviously Obama didn't go for the public option, and obviously expanding Medicare for all, you already have the program in place. It's nothing to expand it incrementally. It obviously could be done, but clearly there's a lot of money that the insurance companies give to the Congress, and that's probably why it can't be done. But
exactly.
But as an interim step, to get a little bit more sanity and a little bit more fairness and stop this unnecessary gouging where the United States has the highest cost for healthcare with the worst outcomes, and that's just a fact, and it's up to about 18%+ of GDP, which is the rest of the civilized world has about 6-8% of GDP, and all of their citizens are covered. So it's a complete disgrace. But you mentioned Kaiser, which is an extremely good operation, and they really do take care of their people. That's the nonprofit model. Is that the interim step between this broken system we have now of private insurance and what we know would be logical and better, which is single payer but may not be attainable? The interim step, could that be just to basically let these insurance bandits fall under their own weight and move to a nonprofit model like Kaiser Permanente?
You know, I think that it's possible. In fact, Kaiser Permanente does a quite a good job, and they are always among the tops in customer satisfaction and quality measures. I think we may ultimately wind up with Kaiser or entities like Kaiser serving most Americans eventually. and that would be a big improvement over what we have now with these for-profit companies. I think also next year in 2017, states will have the ability to innovate under the Affordable Care Act or Obamacare. It was something put in the law that enables states to experiment to see if they can do better than what the federal law has done in terms of expanding coverage to people and to ensure quality of care at lower costs. And I think the state of California will be taking advantage of that, and maybe some other states as well, too. And I think that we'll start seeing states looking to implement their own public option. And I think, in fact, I know that Secretary Clinton, if she is elected president, she said that she will work with states to try to help them implement public options at the state level.
Well, Wendell Potter, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Wendell Potter, who, after a long career in the for-profit health industry, is the chief corporate spokesman at Cigna Corporation and is head of corporate communications at Humana, Inc., is now a senior analyst on healthcare at the Center for Public Integrity. His books include Obamacare, What's in It for Me, What Everyone Needs to Know About the Affordable Care Act, and his latest book is Nation on the Take, How Big Money Corrupts Our Democracy and What We Can Do About It. We're going to take a brief station break and back discussing the Department of Justice's decision today that the U.S. will end federal use of private prisons. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now, Robert Perkinson, who is an American historian and professor of American Studies at the University of Hawaii, the co-founder of a criminal justice reform coalition in Connecticut, and currently the board member of the Drug Policy Forum of Hawaii. He's the author of Texas Tough, The Rise of a Prison Empire. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Perkinson.
Nice to be here.
And Robert, the United States Justice Department just said that they will end the use of the federal use of private prisons, with contracts with 13 private prisoners up for review and allowing them to expire over the next 5 years. So, of course, the federal prisons don't really have, they have a fairly minor percentage of American prisoners. But do you see this as a step in the direction of getting rid of private prisons?
I do. It's a long overdue but welcome step. We've known since the Justice Department investigations in 2001 that private prisons are really not saving very much money except in labor costs, because they tend to pay people very badly. And we know from countless investigations and lawsuits that the safety and medical care records have been checkered. But it is nice to, you know, overdue or not, it's nice to see the Justice Department taking this action.
Well, during the campaign, Senator Bernie Sanders was, I think, the only politician I've heard of to bring up this issue, where he made the campaign promise to end the private for-profit prison racket, saying we cannot fix our criminal justice system if corporations are allowed to profit from mass incarceration. Have you noticed anybody else? I mean, I don't know whether Bernie Sanders has had any effect on this, but it certainly has been, along with for-profit colleges, has been a fairly flagrant racket, but simply allowed to persist. Do they have like the for-profit colleges, have powerful lobbyists in Washington?
Yes, the incentive structure, I mean, Bernie Sanders is right that the incentive structure is all wrong in prisons. Of course, you know, we have for-profit operations all around the country, but for medical care and other important things. But in the case of prisons where, you know, the employees don't have autonomy like doctors have in hospitals and where the population, subject population is kind of without legal voice by definition, it's particularly dangerous to have process in place by which, you know, profit is the primary goal of these companies by their fiduciary duties to their stockholders. And the best way to get profit is to pay guards less and to trim the cost of services, especially medical services. And it's out of that, you know, mismatch of objectives that a lot of this trouble arises.
So I assume that it also means that the bologna sandwiches have cheaper and cheaper bologna.
It's. I mean, you know, this has been tried before, privatizing prisons. That's sort of what my, partially what my book was about. In the South, after the Civil War, entire prison populations were sent to private contractors, farms and mines and so on, and the results were abominable. I mean, tens of thousands of deaths and absolutely horrendous abuse scandals for decades and decades. People learned at that point, and by the beginning of the 20th century, private prisons were phased out. But then as the growth after civil rights kind of went through the roof, as the conservative kind of revolution overtook America, it started again. And the federal government actually has been a pretty big player. There were as many as 30,000 inmates in private lockups, federal prisoners, as of just a couple of years ago.
But it's down to about 14,000 now, isn't it?
Right. And there, that's, I think the goal is with this new memo, the goal is to have it down to 14,000 by next year and to start phasing out entirely after that. Now, there's a huge, though, exception to this. This is a Department of Justice memo. Homeland Security, also through the INS, houses immigrant detainees in private facilities, actually a much greater portion of their population, still about 60% of immigration detainees are held in for-profit facilities, and all of the same problems have materialized there.
And again, I'm speaking with Robert Perkinson, who's an American historian and professor of American Studies at the University of Hawaii. He's the co-founder of a criminal justice reform coalition in Connecticut and currently a board member of the Drug Policy Forum of Hawaii, and is the author of Texas Tough, The Rise of a Prison Empire. So let's talk a bit about this other aspect that the DOJ report, which recommends the federal government phases out the use of prisons through the Bureau of Prisons. However, as you just pointed out, ICE has a huge prison population in private prisons. And indeed, they recently let a $5 billion contract to Christian Corporation of America to build a big facility on the Texas border for the influx of women and children, largely from Central America. That apparently is one of the most outrageous contracts ever written. They couldn't get anybody else to build this prison in the time that they needed. So Correction Corporation sort of had the government over a barrel, wrote this amazing contract. And even if the prison's not full, which it certainly isn't and never has been, it's a big facility, they still collect the same amount of money per beds. And guess what? The equivalent of staying in this detention facility is the equivalent of an expensive room like at a Hilton hotel, about $400 a night.
Right, I'm sure. Yeah. It's in Hawaii, where I am now, the cost of incarceration is about $60,000 a year, which is more than sending folks to Harvard with a nice dorm room. And it's actually remarkable how damning the Inspector General's findings are and the Justice Department's findings are, because, you know, these for-profit prison companies in the federal prison system, they tend to get a better or an easier to manage class of inmates. It's mostly inmates on their way to being released with relatively short sentences. They don't get as many of the really difficult medical cases, those on dialysis or, you know, with chronic heart failure, with life sentences. They tend not to get those in solitary confinement for terrorist crimes. So their rate of violence ought to be lower And yet it's higher. So it's even more damning than it seems. And that same perverse incentive structure, I fear, is going to erupt in larger and larger scandals within the immigrant detention infrastructure as well.
And of course, they ICE, which is a part of Homeland Security, go to great lengths to say it's not really a prison; it's a detention facility. But you know, that seems pretty semantical.
Yes, I mean, legalistically, in a purely legal sense, they are correct. But from the point of view of people who have their liberty deprived and they're held in a secure facility and not allowed to leave, it feels a lot like prison to them. And to those guarding them, the same dynamics develop. And when those guards are, because the companies need to make more money, are less well-trained, the staffing is less robust, the medical and psychological care is, you know, less staffed and less adequate, whoever is the next president is going to face a great number of headaches in this area.
Well, given that the taxpayer is essentially paying the Correction Corporation of America down in this big detention facility they have on the Texas border, the equivalent of about, you know, $400 a night or something per inmate, which you could, you know, the equivalent of what a hotel room, a luxury hotel room would cost. Is the CCA passing on this largesse to the Central Americans in these detention facilities? I mean, if you're going to be getting the equivalent of a expensive hotel per night, does it come along with room service?
Yeah, no, of course not. You know, and if this is, doesn't even deal with how much the U.S. has kind of in recent years, and even more so historically, has kind of set in motion this crisis in Central America that's led to the exodus that we're now dealing with not very effectively. It's a kind of cruel international policy that's now combining with a cruel immigration policy. But it is, I fear, going to be a mess for whoever is president next time around. Of course, if Trump promises to increase the scale of this astronomically, but even if Clinton sort of stays the course, she will inherit a massively bloated immigration detention apparatus, and still, of course, a massively bloated federal prison system. The federal system, until the drug war, was a pretty modest infrastructure for, you know, court-martialed soldiers and tax evaders and those who committed espionage offenses and some mafia kind of defendants, but they have really become bloated with low-level drug offenders. It's still more than 200,000 people in the federal prison system, which is enormous by historical standards. And even though the Obama administration has been trying to make some steps in a sensible direction, they have a long, long way to go, as it's taken 40 years to build up this ineffective, bloated bureaucracy.
Well, given that, again, the percentage of prisoners in the federal system as of December, private prisons housed 22,660 federal inmates out of a total of nearly 200,000, as you just pointed out, and that is going to be phased out over the next 5 years down to zero, presumably. But then, of course, compared to the state system, that's where most of the prisoners are. And that's where the numbers make the United States the number one country in the world for its prison population per capita. And that, of course, when you realize that there are countries, totalitarian countries like China with enormous populations that don't even have
I mean, the U.S. is number one in per capita and in aggregate numbers, which you're exactly right.
Yeah.
You know, we incarcerate 500,000 more people than China, which is an authoritarian regime with four times the population base. It's extraordinary.
It is extraordinary, and it's absolutely shameful. But let's just look into the private prison aspect of where most of the prisoners are, which are in state prisons. I believe there are about 94,365 prisoners being held in private facilities. Do you foresee a kind of trickle-down effect from what the feds have just done to the states?
One hopes that will be the case, because if the federal system was producing this level of kind of safety incidents and egregious kind of medical care faults, then the state systems, upon further investigation, are generally going to fare worse, because in comparison to most states, the federal monitoring system that the Department of Justice had set up was relatively robust. They have, you know, permanent on-site Department of Justice employees monitoring contract compliance in every private facility. That's not true in some other states. You know, they have relatively generous contracts. The wage level can be better than some of the other for-profit prison operators. So if it ought to be a warning to states like Hawaii and Texas and others that have a lot of their population incarcerated in private facilities that they should pay attention to this problem before it gets away from them.
So is there any sense then of where the support came from for these? I mean, is it a part of an overall idea of the anti-government libertarian crowd that are fairly, you know, make up a substantial amount of the Republican Party, even though there isn't obviously a libertarian party, but the idea that government itself is bad?
Yes, you're exactly right.
Is that where this all this stuff came from?
It's been primarily ideological, you know, and chummy, in that as private prisons began to get some contracts in the 1980s, they tended to start hiring, just like defense contractors used to do and still do, you know, high-level officials would exit their government jobs and go to higher-paying private prison jobs, and they maintained their list of government contracts. And but the move has been a lot ideological, and often these contracts and the legislation that it has enabled them have gone through in spite of the evidence. In Texas, when Rick Perry was governor, his independent criminal justice statistical analysis bureau determined that private prisons were really not saving any money in the state, and Governor Perry shut down that office rather than allowing them to publish that report and went ahead and expanded the scope of private prison operations. In 2001, George W. Bush's Attorney General Ashcroft commissioned a study that found that private prisons were not really, the only way they were saving money was by replacing relatively high-wage unionized labor forces in some states with non-union, low-paid labor elsewhere. That's the only, so only by decreasing correction officer wages were they saving the state any money, which actually hurt sometimes those states because then the wages were going out of the state rather than staying in them. Nonetheless, the Justice Department, you know, continued expanding the use of private prisons. So it's an infrastructure that has developed in spite of the best evidence and kind of logic to the contrary. And one hopes that, you know, we are now sobering up from a party we shouldn't have ever attended.
Well, just in closing, of course, by Thursday afternoon, the Correction Corporation of America's stock had plunged by nearly 50%. But, of course, many other of these other private prison companies are privately held, so they're not going to be affected. But we can only hope that this is the beginning of the end for this hideous experiment. I thank you for joining us, Robert Perkinson.
Thank you for having me.
And again, I've been speaking with Robert Perkinson, who's an American historian and professor of American Studies at the University of Hawaii, the co-founder of a criminal justice reform coalition in Connecticut and currently a board member of the Drug Policy Forum of Hawaii. He's the author of Texas Tough, The Rise of a Prison Empire. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.